This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In this program, we've got black swans, boiling frogs, a German philosopher, and the human drive toward collapse. It's another week in these times of EcoShock. Rupert Reed from the University of East Anglia is our first guest, followed by American systems scientist Safa Modashari. But first, with climate change in mind, this message from Leo Tolstoy.
At the advent of danger, there are always two voices that speak with equal force in the human heart. One, very reasonably, invites a man to consider the nature of the peril and the means of escaping it. The other, with a still greater show of reason, argues that it is too depressing and painful to think of the danger, since it is not in man's power to foresee everything and avert the general march of events. And it's better, therefore, to shut one's eyes to the disagreeable until it actually comes, and to think instead of what is pleasant. When a man is alone, he generally listens to the first voice, in the company of his fellow men, to the second. Leo Tolstoy, War and Peace.
The arrival of climate change has been described as a black swan event. It is something we humans have never experienced, and awful impacts are possible. Now, as the weather goes weird and the poles melt, why can't we act against the obvious threat? Rupert Reed is a British academic and Green Party politician. He has worked with the well-known black swan author Nassim Taleb. In the February 23rd issue of The Ecologist magazine, Rupert argues climate change is a white swan. Rupert is the chair of the Greenhouse think tank. He has been the UK Green Party spokesperson on transport and a respected reader in philosophy at the University of East Anglia. I think it's time to meet Rupert Reed. Rupert, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, good to be here.
We have lots to talk about, but why not start with a question any sane person has to ask? We see climate change looming like a dark cloud over the future, so why are we frozen or running in the opposite direction as they are in the United States and Australia at the government level anyway? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so this is really what I'm trying to get at in my thinking about climate change as a white swan. What I mean by that is that now we can see climate change coming straightforwardly towards us. It's no longer a surprise distantly on the horizon. We look at the events in the polar regions right now. We look at the continually rising global temperatures. We see the scientific models getting surer and surer. We've got 99%, not 97% of climate scientists now on board with the accepted wisdom that dangerous climate change is happening and that it's man-made. It's no longer unexpected. It's as common or as expected as seeing a white swan on the river. It's not a surprise anymore. So why can't we see this and respond to it? Why can't we act on it? There's a number of reasons. I think one of the most simple ones is that there are some people with a strong vested interest in continuing for as long as possible to deny what's happening, and they include, of course, fossil fuel magnates, the fossil fuel companies, and so on. But it goes deeper than that. I think that something really strange and worrying is going on, where it's now so obvious that this threat is hanging over us, so obvious that it's dire, and yet there are so many people still in denial. And I argue also that in some ways, most of us are actually at a certain level in denial. We can't really face the extraordinary reality of what is tragically starting to happen. I think it raises big issues for our psychology. I think it raises big philosophical issues, as well as political and economic issues, obviously. So I think we need to do a lot more thinking about this, as well as getting on with it and starting to act on it, because this is dire. It's going to get worse, and our children will never forgive us if we don't get it sorted.
Meanwhile, many of us have been expecting, I think, some sort of paranormal event, a climate impact so gigantic and terrible that all the nations will unite in a rapid response. But what if climate change just crawls in instead, making our lives a bit more difficult and more miserable over the years? What if that's how it arrives?
Yeah, well, that is part of the problem. Part of the reason why it's so hard to grapple with and act on is it doesn't strike people as an emergency. So comparisons are made, for example, with the Second World War. And in many ways, the comparisons are apt. So there was a Holocaust in the Second World War. The devastation that climate change could wreak could be, in the long run, far, far greater than that in terms of the number of people killed. The threat in the Second World War demanded serious action, and yet people were at first slow to act. Winston Churchill was accused of being an alarmist for raising the alarm about what was happening in Nazi Germany. And he said, that's exactly what he said. He said, look, I'm not an alarmist, I'm raising the alarm. There's an important difference. But of course, it was much easier to respond to because it was a threat that was kind of in people's faces, at least by about 1938, 1939. It had a clear enemy. There was a clear trajectory as to what you needed to do to deal with it. These are features which are not present in the case of climate change, which is why I call climate change a diffuse object. It's an object which is very, very difficult to see. It is long-lasting. It is all around us in a certain sense. It is influenced by virtually everything that we do. But, you know, when you started saying, Alex, that what if it's so slow and then we don't react to it, the analogy which is often used is that of frogs, the idea that frogs, if you put them in water and slowly boil the water, that they will get boiled. And what I say in response to that is it turns out that that isn't actually true, that your average frog will jump out of the water at a certain point, even if you turn up the heat very slowly. So one way I like to put this is, can't we be at least as smart as frogs? Right? Can't we be as wise as frogs? One would have thought we were wiser than that. The great philosopher Aristotle said, the thing which is special about humanity is that we are the rational animal. Well, that question is now in the balance. Are we the rational animal or not? If we are at least as rational as frogs, then we will address this, even if it just keeps creeping up on us slowly. And so I think that's maybe a hopeful thought, because I think surely we are at least as rational as frogs.
You know, I've never had the courage or the stupidity to test that out, you know, throw a frog in a bucket and see what happens.
Well, it'd be a bit cruel, wouldn't it?
It would indeed. But we're being very cruel to our children and our grandchildren by carrying on in this warming bucket without taking any action. And I know that you presented a shock message for young students. What did you tell them?
Well, yeah, what I told them was that we are in unprecedented times, that it's no longer possible for us to assume that life as normal and business as usual will go on. I told them that although this was an address to freshmen arriving at university, although it was a wonderful thing to be arriving at university, I frankly, in a very important respect, didn't envy them, because young people, I'm 50 years old, young people are going to face a lot more of this than I am. I mean, I'm very worried about my old age, frankly. I'm worried about what kind of world we're going to be living in. But if you're 15 or 20, it's absolutely a terrifying prospect if you can dare to look it in the face. Well, what does this mean? Well, it means that we have to act. We have to respond. We have to look at this. We have to do it urgently. We also have to do it in a deliberate way over a period of years. It's not going to get solved overnight. If we're going to solve it at all, it's going to take a long time. So then I started to talk with the students about the kinds of things we need to be doing differently. One of the key things, it seems to me, that needs to be brought in now urgently and strongly is the precautionary principle. The precautionary principle basically says that if you're not sure how bad something is going to be, but you know that it could be really bad, then you need to act preemptively to stop it. And that does apply to climate change. I mean, we are sure that climate change is here, basically, unless you're some kind of extremist like Donald Trump. We are sure that climate change is here. We are sure it's man-made. We are sure that it will be bad unless we stop it. But we aren't sure just how bad it's going to be. And some people use that as a prevaricating technique. They say, well, you know, maybe it's not going to be as bad as they say. But of course, the truth is that if you're uncertain how bad something is going to be, that it doesn't just go one way. Climate change could be a lot worse than we think. It could be a lot quicker. It could be a lot more devastating. There are feedbacks that could come in. For example, if we get the Amazon rainforest dying off relatively quickly, or if ocean currents stop working properly, or if there is a sudden jump in methane levels being released in the polar regions or in the seas, dangerous climate change could be a lot worse than the scientists are telling us. The only rational thing to do, the only precautious thing to do, this is what the precautionary principle says, is to act now strongly to stop the worst-case scenario from being able to happen. And, of course, we know the kinds of things that means. It means changing our farming methods radically. It means stopping deforesting the earth. It means, most obviously of all, stopping burning fossil fuel so much, and we have to leave the clear majority of them in the ground. This is going to be very difficult to accomplish because we're dealing with huge vested interests and long ingrained habits. But we can do it. We could do it. And so the responsibility is absolutely on us to do it. And this is why, although in a certain sense it's a terrible time to be alive and a terrible time to be young, in another sense it's an awesome and a hugely exciting time, because what an incredible responsibility, what a chance to be the people who have the chance of actually saving the future and changing the destiny of humankind and putting us onto a much safer track. That is a positive way of looking at the awesome responsibility which now hangs over all of us.
Yes, there's both hope and fear for us there in the younger generation. I want to switch gears a little bit. You know, I've collected pages of headlines warning that robots are coming to take our jobs, all sorts of jobs. And at the Greenhouse Think Tank, I noticed that Andy Permain published an e-article titled Newer Times, What the Age of Robots Means for Labor and Green Politics. But it seems to me in response, you seem to call robotization almost a distraction. Why?
Yeah, so there's a lot of talk about robotization now, including, as you say, from my colleague Andy Permain in the Greenhouse Think Tank. I think that something which has been neglected in all this talk is that the kind of robot utopia or dystopia, whatever it is, that people are talking about and are imagining and saying and are saying is starting to happen already, if that comes in, it's going to demand an enormous increase in use of energy, an enormous increase in use of materials. Now, people say, no, it won't, because robots can be brought in fairly efficiently and so on. But the question here is this. If you're going to have robots additionally to all the people that there already are, then it's bound to increase the pressure on the earth. It's bound to increase energy use. It's bound to increase materials use. I'm very worried about the amount of waste that's going to be generated by broken robots and finished robots and so on and so forth. So why does this mean that I don't actually in the end think that the worry about robotization taking away all our jobs or indeed robots conquering the planet and ruling over us all, why am I not so scared about this as many people are? Well, because I'm more scared of something else, which is that I think that the likely scenario, if we do go down a heavy robot-intensive route of further industrialization in the next 10 or 15 years, is that we will simply hasten ecological collapse. Because the Earth cannot tolerate any more burdens on it in terms of resource extraction, pollution, energy overuse. We're straining up against, we're breaching the limits to growth. Dangerous climate change is simply the most obvious symptom of this and the most direly, directly harmful to us. So what I think will happen if we do go down the robotization path, as currently seems to be likely, unless we manage again to change society's direction quite radically, what I think is likely to happen is it will simply accelerate ecological collapse. It will simply accelerate the time when we start to go into a vicious circle of worsening conditions and societies falling apart, most likely, although not necessarily, through climatic disaster. Through a series of climatic disasters, indeed, which people call climate chaos, as well as just the general ratcheting up of the temperature worsening the climatic situation for us across the planet. Robotization, if it's not stopped, I think is less likely to lead to a kind of robot apocalypse or even to robots taking away all our jobs, and more likely to lead to an intensified and more rapid period of climate disaster. And now here's the thing. If the robot lovers, if the people who say, oh, robots are going to be great, you know, they'll give us all a leisurely future, etc., if those people are actually serious, if they're saying that robots can actually reduce our ecological footprint, remember we're living right now in countries like the UK and the US as if we have four or five planets. When I last looked, we only had one. If those people are right in thinking that robots could actually reduce our ecological footprint, then they have a very interesting and actually very unpleasant thing to explain, which is how is that going to be possible without a massive forced reduction in human population? Because that's the only way I can see the figures adding up. You see, See what I'm saying? If the robots, as they inevitably are going to do, are going to have a significant ecological footprint, a significant impact upon us ecologically, the only way the figures add up is if there are a hell of a lot less humans quite quickly. So what I would like to ask the advocates of a robot future is, which humans precisely do you want to replace? Which people or which peoples are going to be told that they cannot reproduce or indeed forcibly contained in their numbers? What's it going to be, a mass sterilization program or something? The only way that the figures add up, the only way it's going to be possible for there to be a robot-heavy future which doesn't destroy us ecologically is if there are hugely less people very quickly. I say that's not possible. I say, therefore, that in order to have a humane future, we have to stop the trend towards robotization. Don't get me wrong, by the way, Alex. I don't believe that the currently very high and growing human population of the world is sustainable. But that's even without robot growth in numbers. I think what we need to do is find a way of gradually building down the numbers of human beings on the planet through non-authoritarian means. We need to persuade people through family planning and through thinking rationally about what will be a better human future and so on and so forth, that it would be better to have a globe on which there were 7 billion people than 10 billion, and maybe in the long run better to have one with 5 or 6 billion, and we can carry on thinking about what exactly are the best numbers, the numbers which actually add up to human life on Earth being compatible with our ecological stability, as well as being a flourishing, enjoyable life. But all you do, if you add on robots on top of that, is you make it harder and harder to have an ecologically stable and sane future. So that's why I say, no, robotization cannot go on in the way that people are talking about. And people who are thinking about things in a green kind of way have to start talking about this.
There is a whole bag full of really sharp knives in what you just said. I mean, I could see a point where the billionaires meet in a little room and decide they don't need a few billion of us. Or I could see that robots themselves would have to become consumers because we won't be able to afford the products that they make, and on and on. I have to get something in here. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Rupert Reed from the University of East Anglia. We're talking about why real action on climate change is such a struggle for all of us. Now, part of that struggle, Rupert, has been the Green Party, and particularly in Europe, it's been green politics. What has been your role in that?
Well, so I've stood a number of times for Parliament and for the European Parliament. Unfortunately, of course, we have a very inequitable political system in Britain, as we do in the US and in most countries, frankly, in the world. It's very hard for the Green Party to break through with the electoral system. And even when the electoral system is fairer, even when you have proportional representation, it's still hard for the Green Party to get fairly represented because the media are stacked against us. We don't have rich donors like most of the other parties do. So it's hard to make progress as part of the Green Party. I see the Green Party as a vital part of the chance we have, which is, I think, frankly, a slim chance, but it still exists, the chance we have of saving ourselves and returning to some kind of ecological sanity, because we need to be acting at every level. We need to live in a different way in our day-to-day lives and in our communities. We need to act in our workplaces to try to change those. And, of course, many of us have real power as laborers, as workers, especially if we're in a trades union, as I am. And we need to act in the political system, and that means things like direct action. It means things like demonstrations and lobbying, but it crucially means elections, too. I say to people sometimes, why lobby your member of parliament if you could be your member of parliament? And that's what I've sought to be, unsuccessfully as yet. Hopefully that may change in the future. We do, of course, have some brilliant elected green politicians in the UK, including at the head of us all, Caroline Lucas, our absolutely amazing member of Parliament in the Houses of Parliament for the Green Party.
Yes, indeed. Now, as you know, Rupert, every politician promises growth. We've been told the economy will collapse into massive unemployment without growth. And the Greenhouse think tank has a post-growth project. What do you mean, and how could that work?
Yeah, so this is another crucial part of the picture. As you say, Alex, unfortunately, the idea of economic growth still remains largely hegemonic. It remains largely dominant around the world and in public discourse and in the media. And this is basically a disaster. It's a continual ecological disaster in the making, because the more growth that you have, or the more you try to bring about economic growth, the more pressure you place on ecosystems, the less room you leave for wildlife, the less room you leave for the kind of functions that the Earth performs for us in terms of regulating and absorbing pollution and so on and so forth. So, yeah, we in Greenhouse are saying we have, as a human race, and we have in our societies, to start to think beyond economic growthism. After all, what is growth supposed to be for anymore? We already live in countries like the United States, Canada, and the UK. We already live in a position where most of us, frankly, have enough. Now, of course, some of us don't have enough, but some of us have way too much. We need to share better. That's what we need to do, not grow the economy more. We need to get the rich to give up a little of what they have, and then everyone will have enough. We don't need any more economic growth. And economic growth, as I say, it simply puts more and more pressure on our vital ecosystems, without which we are nothing. Every bit of economic growth means more straining against the limits to growth, limits such as the capacity of our atmosphere to absorb pollution, limits such as the fact that raw materials, so-called, are running out. So in Greenhouse, we have this post-growth project. If people want to look at it, I'd urge them to go to our website, greenhousethinktank.org, and find out more about it. We're part of an alliance around the world, the post-growth alliance of people who are thinking the same way. And this kind of thinking is gradually starting to become acceptable as people realize that growth isn't all it's cracked up to be. People realize that it's pushing us into a completely unsustainable situation. And as people realize that there are real alternatives, we could have a society now which didn't grow anymore, which satisfied human needs, and which allowed us to be ecologically sane, ecologically stable. What's not to like? We think that this is an idea whose time has very much come, and the word needs to spread on this, and it needs to spread fast.
Well, I'd like to now venture into some new territory for our listeners. You are known as a scholar of the late Ludwig Wittgenstein. And pardon my bumbling around in this. I did study it at university several decades ago, but I've forgotten almost everything about that. But I do know that in his early work in the 1920s, Wittgenstein suggested that words work by triggering pictures of facts in our minds. That was his early theory, I think. Now, there is no human memory of climate shift. Is that part of the problem? We don't have the pictures for a different climate, and so language fails.
Interesting. I think that there's something in what you've said there, definitely. I think that the way in which we have been trained to think, the scenarios that we are used to, these things are not preparing us well for the unprecedented situation of dangerous climate change. There are precedents of a sort. For example, Jared Diamond discusses them in his work, for example, his fascinating book, Collapse, How Human Societies Choose to Fail, which I think is a great title. When societies fail, it's not usually because some terrible fate simply befalls them. They do things which set themselves up for failure. And unfortunately, that's what we're doing right now. But these precedents, the kind of examples that Diamond talks about, of course, they only existed before on much smaller scales. We've never had a truly worldwide crisis before. Actually, that's not quite true. There is one hopeful precedent there, which is, of course, the ozone layer crisis, the ozone hole, which occurred in the 1980s. But that was easier to fix, and it was basically fixed, and this is why it's an encouraging precedent. That was easier to fix than the climate crisis because it didn't concern so much of what human beings do. It wasn't so integrally tied in with economic activity as a whole. So I think you're right, Alex, in saying that something which is a problem for us is that our history hasn't prepared us well for this crisis that we find ourselves in now. In terms of how Wittgenstein's thinking can contribute to this, one thing I would draw attention to is that Wittgenstein was a skeptic about the idea of human progress. Now, that might sound very unattractive to many listeners. Many listeners might think, hey, human progress, that's what it's all about. That's absolutely essential to who we are. We've got to stand behind the idea of human progress. But what Wittgenstein basically said was that he thought that the idea of progress, if that idea means something which is supposed to be continuous, and certainly if that idea is tied into material progress and material growth, is a kind of fake idea and a fake ideal, which has been actually a very recent idea, It wasn't present in most of the great societies of antiquity, for example. It simply wasn't present at all there. And Wittgenstein thinks that there are other objectives which we should place much higher than these kind of ideas of progress. He thinks that real quality of life and real quality, for example, of thought and of artistic production, that these are ideas which are better than our ideas of progress or development or growth, which have led us astray. That, I think, is an intriguing idea in Wittgenstein's philosophy, which is one that I've tried to follow up in my work in recent years.
And did he not later in his life come to the conclusion that language was not a game necessarily based on rational conclusions from the facts, but rather patterns of words with intentions to convey things like comfort or security? But then I think of Donald Trump. Maybe he's unknowingly using this failure of language to avoid the facts of climate change, but he talks about discomfort and he tries to breed insecurity in his listeners. It's very confusing to me.
That's an idea I haven't heard before, that Donald Trump might be a Wittgensteinian. I don't think so. I think, by the way, that one of the few silver linings of the current awful political situation, and it is frankly awful, we need to be quite clear about that with ourselves, it calls for a huge response in a very different direction. I think one of the few things that's good about it is that Trump and his ilk will be thrown into the dustbin of history as it becomes clearer and clearer that dangerous climate change is happening and that they have stoked it. I actually think it's entirely possible that Trump might even flip on this issue in this year or in the next few years. For example, there are so many people in the Pentagon who are quite clear about what's happening. The Pentagon understand that human-induced climate change is the greatest security threat of our time. I think that it's hard to be a president, especially a president of the kind that Trump wants to be, who wants to put America first, who doesn't even listen to his own advisors in the Pentagon. So we'll see how that develops. In terms of how Wittgenstein's later ideas might be relevant, really I think the idea which is most crucial here, it ties in with what I was saying a couple of minutes ago about how Wittgenstein was actually skeptical about the way that we are captured by this idea of progress, is that in Wittgenstein's later work, he emphasized very much the importance of human forms of life, ways of living that we are accustomed to as the basis for anything that we do. And I think that we may come to realize more as the threat from issues such as climate rises in the coming years, and it will become more and more starkly clear to us. I think that what we are about to lose will start to come home to us. And the way that our very forms of life, our very forms of existence, and indeed language itself, are under threat by all of this, will start to become clearer to us, and that perhaps when the stakes are clearer, we will move and respond and act in a different way. Now, the problem is, Alex, that if we leave it much longer, it simply will be too late. So we have to do something smart. We have to get ahead of the curve. We have to educate ourselves, we have to spread the word, we have to put our bodies on the line sometimes, we have to put our money on the line. I would say to listeners out there who might have £10,000 or $100,000 stashed away, this money is going to be no good to you. It's going to be no good to your children if the ecological crisis comes and crunches us in the way that it's looking likely to do over the next generation. Be bold. Put that money now towards some places where it can actually do good. Put it into the political process behind people like Greens or others who have their hearts and their minds in the right place on these issues. Or put it into projects which can actually help right now to conserve the world or to grow food in a better way. I think people need to think big. This is, as we've said, an unprecedented moment in human history, and we will be judged as to whether we think big enough on it.
Where can our listeners find out more about you and your work?
Well, one place to start on the web is at www.rupertreed.net, where you can find a link to most of my various activities. You can follow me on Twitter at Green Rupert Reed, and that's R-E-A-D. Green Rupert Reed, and I'm not too hard to find. I'm a pretty active voice out there, and I'd love to hear from people, hear what they think of this broadcast, and I hope that we'll get more and more people joining us in what we're trying to do here. I think your radio station is very aptly named EcoShock. There is going to be a terrible EcoShock coming down the road unless we act like wise frogs and do it sooner rather than later. And I'd love to be a part of working on this with listeners.
Well, there's another part of the shock, too, intended there, and that's the sort of medical state of shock where people are in an accident and then they can't think straight for a little while. I think that's sort of where we are. We've fallen into this sort of tar pit, a trap for intelligent beings by discovering fossil fuels that stored sunlight in the earth. And I know there's quite a few YouTube videos with yourself in it, and I'm going to put links to some of your articles and YouTube videos and, of course, your site at the Greenhouse Think Tank, all that. I'll put it in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. We have been speaking with Dr. Rupert Reed. He's a reader in philosophy at the University of East Anglia. He's the chair of the Greenhouse Think Tank, as I've said, and he has been trying to be a green representative and also has often been a spokesperson for the UK Green Party. Rupert, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. It's really been a pleasure.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio. For the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Scientists have created complex models that project an extreme climate shift. And these models reach down into deforestation, agricultural impacts, changes to the oceans, ice worlds, and atmosphere. But now we know humans are the driving force in a new geologic age called the Anthropocene. Scientific climate models have the physics and the chemistry, but so far they lack the most difficult thing, how humans will further twist and tilt natural systems. A paper published in the National Science Review in December 2016 addresses that. This work from a team of 20 authors deals with overshoot, the trajectory of collapse, and the way growing inequality of wealth can break our system down. I've reached the lead author, Dr. Safa Modashari. He's a systems scientist at the University of Maryland. Safa Modashari, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
It's great to be with you. Thanks, Alex.
This new work from your team, it's deep and it's long, but before we get there, I'd like to build a base from an earlier paper you published in 2014 with Jorge Ribas and Irene Calne. And the title is Human and Nature Dynamics, Modeling Inequality and the Use of Resources in the Collapse or Sustainability of Societies. I've just talked with Dr. Cameron Petrie about the downfall of the Indus civilization a few thousand years ago. In the same program, Dr. Takeshi Inamata told us about the collapse of the Mayan society. So it does happen. Are serious people concerned about the possibility of collapse in our own civilization?
That's an interesting question, Alex. I work on dynamical systems, a field devoted to studying the properties and evolution of systems with interconnected components and variables. Collapse is characterized by fast reduction in one or many variables in that system. It's a possibility in almost any dynamic system, given certain structures and parameter values. And the human system in a specific geographical region, together with its natural resources, it's a dynamic system. And therefore, it's not an exception from such possibility.
Well, now, in your 2014 paper, in the abstract, we find, quote, "We build a human population dynamics model by adding accumulated wealth and economic inequality to a predator-prey model of humans and nature." And I'm thinking these days a few billionaires are piling up the wealth while the middle class almost evaporates and poverty expands, even in developed countries. Has our society developed a class of predators and prey comparable to nature?
Right. Many people wonder about that and ask us about this issue. So within the framework of the Handy model, we consider the depletion of natural resources as a predation mechanism, similar to what was done in the theoretical model of predator-prey in biology. The stock of nature is the prey, and the stock of human population plays the role of the predator. Nonetheless, inequality by itself is included as a central element in the Handy model, in the sense that the elites, they control the stock of wealth, which allows them to live off of what the masses produce. And this gives elites a buffer in the event of a collapse. It postpones their collapse for a few years or a few decades but it cannot save them forever.
I find that very interesting, that humans are really the predators here and the prey is nature itself. I hadn't really thought of it that way, but it sounds true. So many biologists have worked out the carrying capacity for everything from wolves to plankton, but they're leaving something out, you say?
Yes, this is an important question, and it's a topic that we plan to write a more comprehensive paper about in the future. From the traditional point of view of biology or ecology, carrying capacity is a parameter, often a constant, that's determined a priori for the system. But we show that for the human system, carrying capacity is a more complex dynamic variable that's determined by the structure and the properties of the system. It's not something that we can prescribe in our models before we run them. It results from simulation of the model. And most importantly, we show that carrying capacity can change and can evolve over time as a result of policy choices and decisions, particularly decisions we make about natural resource management.
You know, something that you're saying here is stimulating a memory in me, and I can't pinpoint it, but it was about systems and the way seemingly stable systems can run for a long time, and then rather than decline, they just fell apart. Is that something that you've encountered in your model runs?
Yes, this is a very good point, actually. This brings up the issue, you know, we show that in our handy paper, this was one of the features of the paper that made it very attractive to our academic colleagues and to the academic community and also to the public. So we showed there are two different trajectories or routes to a collapse. So one is overexploitation of nature, which we call type N collapses in our handy paper, which is a typical case of collapses, and people have known about that before. But then we show a different route to a collapse, where initially the system seems apparently on a steady state path, and the system is otherwise sustainable. But then we introduce a large level of inequality into the system. And after that, we see that the system moves towards a collapse. You know, this is what we call the type L, or collapse due to overexploitation of labor. L stands for labor. And this is definitely something that we have seen in historical cases. For example, the collapse of the Maya civilization represents this mechanism fairly well.
I wonder, too, if the collapse of the Soviet Union wouldn't come under that, in the sense that people weren't getting a lot from the government that demanded everything of them, and people stopped believing in the system. There was a collapse of belief.
That's a slightly different than what we discuss, but it could be understood beyond the framework that we proposed in the handy model.
All right, well, let's move forward to your new paper of 2016. Why did your team of 20 experts decide on this pursuit?
So current models that are used to guide important policies nationally and internationally, such as the integrated assessment models or the models used for the IPCC reports, they make projections of the climate and the rest of the Earth system variables and components based on long-term demographic and economic forecasts that are done independently. But in reality, all of these key human system components are connected with two-way feedbacks to natural components. So we propose the modeling community to shift toward a new paradigm of modeling, which is including all of these human system variables as dynamic variables in the model with bidirectional feedbacks to the Earth system components, as it is happening in the real system, in the real world. And we were really fortunate to work with a team of distinguished scientists whose expertise and background was in multiple different aspects of both the Earth system and the human system. And they helped us really put together this framework and make sure we consider different aspects that are critical in developing such a framework.
I think that's really important, what you've just said, and it's a huge topic. We're going to talk more about it as we continue this interview with Safa Modashari. So Owen Gaffney and Will Steffens were on our program. They published their equation for the operation of humans and nature in the Anthropocene. And on Radio EcoShock, Owen talked about the great acceleration seen in almost every trend of human action since 1950. Does that figure in your paper?
Absolutely. So if you look at the first figure in our paper, figure number one, we have a plot that shows the development and the trajectory of the human population and human consumption per capita since 2,000 years ago up until today. And that shows, you know, two points, basically from the beginning of industrial civilization, 1750, and then from 1950, beginning of the Green Revolution, we have two rapid periods of growth in both of these variables. And you have to remember that our total impact on the planet is the product, is the multiplication of these two. So we have two extremely rapidly growing factors, and the multiplication, the product of the two, is our total impact on the planet, which we calculate actually in that figure in the paper. And we show that since 1950 onward, every 17 years, once every 17 years, the total impact has doubled. This is shockingly rapid.
Well, in this program, we talk a lot about how feedbacks in climate change could destabilize the human system and everything from agriculture to more deaths from heat and flooding. But what about the feedbacks you're talking about that humans impose on the natural system? Is there an important interaction in all this?
That's an excellent question, Alex. So we devoted a major portion of the paper to discussing these feedbacks in both directions. So most of the literature, academic literature, and most what we people know about are the impacts that the human system has on the planet. You know, with the impact on the climate, impact on oceans, on land, and so on and so forth. But we look at also there are feedbacks, impacts of the Earth system on the human system, on the society. And we discuss that, you know, we discuss this in details in the paper.
These Earth system models, they're huge models running on multiple computers and great big computing centers, and they're used by groups like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and many other institutions, and that's what advises governments when they do a deal like the Paris Agreement. From what you're saying, it sounds like these models are missing an essential part of the picture. Maybe they're way off on what's going to happen.
Yes, that's a critical point, and that's the central message of our paper. So these models and these people who run these models, they are very talented and brilliant people, and these models are very detailed and complicated model, and they've accomplished a lot. But the key factor is that we need to have those feedbacks, the bidirectional feedbacks between the human elements and the Earth system, the natural elements, in order to get realistic projections of the future. There are many scenarios, many situations that we can miss, important signals indeed, that we can miss if we don't include these feedbacks. And we really hope that these institutions and these large organizations that run these models and already have the capacity and the talent and the tools necessary to implement such models actually take our proposed paradigm and implement it their own models.
Safa, I have to sympathize, though, with climate scientists, especially under pressure of denial coming out of the Trump administration. Earth scientists are comfortable modeling ice melt and ocean currents. Those are physical events with solid numbers. Is it fair to ask them to add in the rapidly changing human economy as well?
Right. That's, again, another one of the central points of the paper. And this question is raised a lot. We are arguing in the paper that because humans have become the major drivers of the changes in the natural systems and the Earth system, understanding long-term trajectory of natural system can no longer be done accurately without including these effects from the human system. So we must model the human system as well. We have to do it. Of course, you know, this is not a trivial task. This is not obvious. And it's stepping out of the comfort zone of the natural scientist or earth system scientist. But it's something that has to be done, and we have to start as soon as possible. It's a learning curve, but the more we delay it, the more dangers we might be facing.
Radio EcoShock.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex, and my guest is Dr. Safa Modashari from the University of Maryland. We're talking about the interaction of human systems with climate and a strained ecosphere. Safa, could you give us an example of the sort of human shift that could do serious damage to an Earth system model if it's not included?
Yes. Obvious example is this explosive growth of human population and the massive use of fossil fuels, what we have already seen since 1950. And this is what we show in the first graph of the paper. And that's an obvious example. There are many other examples. There are many other projections that can change the per capita consumptions and change in the standard of living and so on and so forth. But the obvious example is what has happened in the history in the recent past.
Is it possible this civilization has already begun a process of collapse, but we just don't know it yet?
We have to be careful about the boundary of the system when we talk about collapses. Do we mean collapse in a city, in a province, in a country, or in a larger region like the Middle East, or the collapse of the whole world? We have to always draw the boundary. Of course, there are several examples of current collapses, you know, countries that have collapsed. Most important one, most famous one is Syria, but there are several others like Somalia, Yemen, Congo, Sudan, and many other failed states.
Yes, I'd add Venezuela to that list, or at least it's in the process of collapsing, it appears, at this time. We talked about the billionaires who control most of the world's wealth, and there are billions of people who continue in abject poverty. Is it fair to say that wealth inequality is also an environmental issue now?
Absolutely. Yes, that's a great point, Alex. And this is absolutely true. We discuss in the paper, and we show, even like the earlier paper, that it's not just, you know, one number about, you know, how much, you know, what's the average, what's the number. It's the distribution of wealth and consumption and emissions that matters. And the more skewed this distribution is, the larger the inequality, the impact, the total emissions, the total consumption, and the total impact on the planet is higher. So, yes, definitely this is a key issue.
I don't think most environmentalists realize that yet, although they may be on board with the issue of wealth inequality. Can you locate that same wealth inequality as a driver of collapse in any earlier human civilization?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, this was one of the main points of our handy paper that we discussed. There was, for example, the Mayan collapse, which was a case of type L collapse, which was a result of high levels of inequality, and also the collapse of the Roman empires and many others that happened certainly because of high rates of inequality.
Is there a realistic way to fix it, to right the economic injustice?
Absolutely. I mean, we don't discuss those. We're not experts on how to do this, and so we don't discuss those in the papers, but there are definitely ways, and there are experts who do that, who discuss, you know, different ways that are possible. But we show that if we do reduce this level of inequality, then we can bring the system into a steady state and a sustainable state.
Interesting. So where do the big computer models of Earth systems get their information now on demographics and economics, and what's wrong with that way of doing things?
Great question. So IAMs, integrated assessment models, usually use the projections by international organizations such as the United Nations for demographic projections and the World Bank for economic projections and similar other projections. The problem is that many non-trivial solutions, many non-trivial trajectories of the whole system cannot be derived from these exogenous projections. Those variables like population or consumption inequality can go only one way in this way of doing the models, in this like one-way coupled models, which is the projected way. You project it, so that's the only way that it can evolve over time. There's no other way. But in reality, those variables can evolve in many different ways and many non-trivial, surprising trajectories and solutions can emerge.
And you talk about human system models. I'm dubious that's possible with billions of quasi-intelligent and randomly creative or destructive beings. Who has those models and how good are they?
This is probably the most common doubt people have with our proposed framework. So you're absolutely right. We cannot model human choices and predict what people will do, at least, you know, at this time and with the current stage of models of human cognition and decision making. And because of that, we don't discuss it in the paper. Rather, we take policies as choices, as knobs that you can tweak, and you can, based on those choices, based on those policies, you can get different trajectories and different outcomes in the future.
Safa, have you found resistance among Earth scientists to incorporating the work on human systems?
Fortunately, most Earth scientists and natural scientists that we have collaborated or communicated with agree with our thesis about coupling these systems, Earth and human systems, with feedbacks. Maybe not all of them would like to be actively involved in the implementation process because this would be, you know, out of their comfort zone. But few disagree with the importance of including these feedbacks in the systems. And we received, you know, massive support from our peers and our academic colleagues in terms of the future direction of the modeling community.
I've been thinking about your paper over a few days, and if I were a politician supported by fundraising from rich people and corporations, the tone of your team's paper is almost revolutionary. I mean, economic justice is not on the agenda right now. We're not hearing about it in the TV news. It's something for lefties maybe or smaller governments in South America to talk about. But again, just so we don't miss it in the political fog, what happens if we ignore what is happening with wealth distribution?
You're right. You're right. The issue of inequality does not seem to be on the agenda for the politicians. And I wouldn't agree that it's not for common people. You know, people can see the dangers from these high levels of inequality, and we need to include them. So we should, and we should certainly in the future and currently discuss more the inequality and its implications, particularly from a purely scientific point of view, you know, from a point of view of what happens if these levels of inequality increase, what happens to the system, to both, you know, the human system and the natural system.
Is anybody already working to combine these human systems to the integrated assessment models that are used to advise governments and corporations?
I don't know personally any group or institution that's currently providing policy advice using two-way coupled models. So that's why we're proposing that we need to have those, and we hope that the institutions that are currently using one-way coupled models, they move toward this new paradigm of modeling that we propose.
And what will you be researching next?
So a couple of things. So one of the things, important things that we are working on right now is the natural follow-up to the current paper. So in the current paper, we showed basically a framework. We proposed a framework to couple the Earth system and human system. But we have actually developed also an example of this model. It's a coupled human climate water model, and we have validated it with the past observations. It runs for the region of Phoenix in Arizona, and we are preparing a manuscript based on that for submission to a scientific journal. And following that, we're also hoping to write, you know, as I discussed earlier, we're hoping to write an introduction to carrying capacity, the concept of carrying capacity from the point of view of dynamic systems, and introducing carrying capacity as a dynamic variable for human systems.
Is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
Two points that I always like to raise when I discuss my work. One thing is that always preventing catastrophes is much cheaper and much easier done before they occur compared to fixing the results and consequences of catastrophes. That's why, you know, that's why we try to develop these models. We try to discuss these issues before they happen and propose solutions that are relatively easy to implement, cheap to implement, and they can have the best, it's the win-win situation for everyone. So that's one point. And the second point is that I think the key for successfully doing this, for successfully making these right decisions before, you know, catastrophes happen, is education. Is education at its widest definition, both formal education, as it's done, you know, in school and colleges, and also education through media. That's exactly why we need, you know, many great journalists like yourself to communicate, you know, science and evidence unbiased to the public and inform them. And because of that, I really like to congratulate you for your great work and thank you for talking with me about this.
Well, I appreciate that. We've been talking about a big new paper from a team of 20 scientists. The title is Modeling Sustainability, Population, Inequality, Consumption, and Bidirectional Coupling of the Earth and Human Systems. It's a big title, but I think it's kind of revolutionary, and that's why I'm glad we had this chance to talk about it. It was published in the National Science Review in December 11th, 2016. You can find links to the science discussed in this program in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Our guest is Dr. Safa Modashari, the systems scientist from the University of Maryland. Safa, thank you so much for your help.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Now that's a loaded hour. Good for you for going all the way. I'm Alex. Thank you for listening, and please join me again next week for Radio EcoShock.